Housekeeping items. So this is the February 15th basic contributor call. I've dropped the link in the chat for those of you who'd like to follow along. Thanks for everyone who contributed to the agenda. The housekeeping, there's the antitrust notice. Follow that, please. This meeting is being recorded. Please mute unless you're being talking, unless you're talking, of course. And then if you have questions, raise a hand feature. That seems to work pretty well. I think that's it. And then I think there's something about the code of conduct. Please follow that too. I think so. Just looking at, we have an hour together, so we have probably a few updates. I think, of course, we'll probably take most of the time on the incentive program updates. I know Tim is here, and we can talk about the latest version and feedback comments from the group. I think I'm cautiously optimistic that maybe we'll have some time at the end to run through the rest of the items, or I'd love to leave maybe 15 minutes at the end to kind of talk about. There's like a bunch of open forum items and release updates, and I think just, you know, our regular business that we should probably try to get to as well. So maybe let's kind of time box this for maximum 45 minutes, which I think should be okay, but correct me if I'm wrong, and then kind of get on with the rest of it. Does that sound all right? Danielle, go ahead.
Good morning, everyone, and good afternoon. Just wanted to let everybody know that we made an announcement yesterday, or actually last week, about our new Hyperledger Foundation CTO. In case you missed it, we're very happy that Hart Montgomery, who many of you have known for many years, he's been part of the Hyperledger community and part of the technical steering committee since the beginning, since 2016. So he's one of the original TSC members who participated. So he officially starts tomorrow morning here at the Linux Foundation as a Linux Foundation employee and in his role of Hyperledger certified Chief Technology Officer. So, congratulations to Hart. I am so pleased that I'm going to have Hart along with me leading our community. He has been briefed, from most of the client incentive program, and is an additional resource for us. So, just want to let everybody know that Hart is on the phone today and is representing the Hyperledger Foundation and the Linux Foundation as an our CTO. Not as a, not as a TSC member or as a contributor or maintainer.
Thanks, Daniela, for the kind words, and thank you, everybody. I have to drop off this call a couple minutes early, but I should be able to stay on for most of it.
Well, yeah, congrats, Art. Happy to have you here. Was happy to have you here as a TSC member, but even more happy to have you here as a CTO member. So congrats, that's exciting. Big step for Hyperledger. Cool. So incentive program. So maybe just a quick recap for everybody, because it's been a couple weeks and things seem to fly around quite a bit. So we reviewed the proposal number three at the last last contributor call meeting. I think we generally agreed, but there were and we can look at the notes from last time to kind of talking about that further. But I think we generally agreed on a lot of the high-level points, like around the transaction fees, around the withdrawal keys. And but the one open question that was kind of still unclear was like the different roles within the basic community and being able to participate in this incentive program. So Tim kind of owned that action item to kind of redo the or add that in, kind of talking about what are the different definitions of kind of who's eligible for what, and tried to make that kind of clear in this version four. So Tim, does it make sense to maybe, so I'll pause there, maybe hold on, quick questions, and then maybe I'll let Tim talk to this. But any initial questions or comments or anything else we should recap on? Cool. Okay. Tim's floor is yours to kind of just walk through what you did and how you kind of came up with this, I think, tiering
Great.
system. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you mind if I share my screen just so, because I'm probably going to jump back and forth in the doc. I put the link. So the link is on Hyperledger Wiki, but then it's like a nested link to my HackMD document that I didn't have time to reformat. So I posted that in the chat directly if people want to follow along. High level, yeah, there's a couple kind of changes from like the proposal 3 and 3.5. I guess the way I went about making those changes is I spent a lot of the past 2 weeks talking with the folks involved in this process. So I talked with folks at Consensus, folks at HLF, talked with Dano a lot, and tried to get to a spot, and also, sorry, talked with some folks at the EF, and I think I was trying to get to a spot where like we have something that generally fits with what people want, is technically doable, and ideally is legally doable, which is the last kind of open question we have. And I guess my goal with this proposal is to get kind of conceptual agreement across the Basic community. If this is something that like people are happy with, then the next step would be for us and HLF and Consensus to just kind of send it to lawyers and draft like a more formal agreement. So this is basically, you know, kind of think of it as like a design doc for the grant agreement. In terms of the actual changes based on the previous proposals, one kind of formatting thing is I tried to like regroup all of the definitions together. So that, I apologize, it kind of changes the flow of the document a lot. It means you have to reread the whole thing. You can't just look at a diff. But the goal is that ideally things are like only defined once, whereas the previous ones kind of had like double definitions for a bunch of stuff, and that can get confusing. So I tried to kind of group that together. Like Grace said, I think the biggest, conceptual change is just like delineating the different kind of levels of engagement of both individual contributors and organizations. Then technically, this is something that came, you know, with talking with the folks at the EF who have a lot of experience running validators. Previous versions of the proposals had this idea where you would send transaction fees like prorated to different addresses for different validators. And there's a lot of just like operational complexities to do that. It's probably much simpler to just have a smart contract on chain, which like splits funds. And that's a pretty solved problem if you're just dealing with ETH. And that gives the nice property that like you can put specific percentages and specific addresses have a claim over that, but you don't need to send funds back and forth between different organizations. And you only need, when you update the kind of splitting contract, you can update every single validator at once to the same address. It's easy to check that you've done it right. Because of that, assuming we went to use a smart contract, you need kind of a distribution of addresses and their share of contributions to send to. So that means you kind of need to look at the previous period to send the current period's rewards. So you kind of have a small offset there. So that's just something to be mindful of. And then withdrawal key distribution basically is kind of the part that's made a bit more explicit around the different kind of types of contributors. So there's just the first section with definition. Thanks a ton, Dano, for the mainnet development. I think you've had like the best crisp definition of it, and I literally copy pasted it into this. And I think this is like the most important part. So I tried to really delineate like what type of people or organizations involved in BaseU would have access to what type of rewards from the program. And at a high level, there's like four buckets. First, you just have contributors. So these are people who write code for BaseU. They're not maintainers. And so these people basically don't get a share of transaction fees, validator rewards, or withdrawal distributions, withdrawal key distributions. You know, they just contribute and that's it. If BaseU has paid bounties and stuff like that, obviously they can be eligible for those, but they don't get like any funds flowing from the program directly sent to them. Then the kind of next level is you have a maintainer that's working on mainnet. So this is somebody who is listed as an active maintainer. There's a list of active maintainers as part of BaseU and whose work is focused on the Ethereum mainnet. These individuals would be eligible for a share of the transaction fees and validator rewards. And I haven't really changed how that's distributed based on the past proposals, but they're not eligible for withdrawal key distributions yet. And, you know, the way I think you define a mainnet maintainer is somebody who has at least a single substantial contribution to Baseview during a specific 6 months period. I gave some examples here. I think at a high level, what you want a substantial contribution to be is like either a whole new feature, a performance improvement, a security fix. I don't have as strong of an opinion on what's not a significant contribution, but off the top of my head, like a single EIP that just changed a gas cost or like a new JSON RPC API that's like a, you know, very close to an existing one, that seems not like substantial. It is a fuzzy line to draw, and I don't think I'm necessarily the best one, but yeah, I think at a high level, if you've implemented like a large feature into Baseview that's relevant to mainnet within a 6 month period, you should be eligible. The next step for that is, I think, basically,
Tim, when you start. Can I ask a question on that real quick?
Yep.
So we have our own definition of maintainer right now, as far as like rolling people in.
Yep.
Would you like us to improve that so it's more in line with this?
No, sorry.
You killed two birds with one stone there if we were like, okay, you made maintainer, so, you know.
The challenge, though, is a lot of the maintainers on Baseview might never work on mainnet, right? And so I think you need this, like, other filter that's, like, a bit... This is, I guess, the difference between, like, the Baseview project and the incentive
right.
program. Like, if you have somebody who say, I'm old, my Baseview knowledge, but works on, like, you know, the privacy... For like, I think it's Orion.
I understand that. I was more thinking with regard to quantity or size of the contribution as opposed to the type. I think we have a pretty clear idea of what's mainnet and what's not.
Right. And I think, yeah, if you all want to come with like a better list than that, like I just don't know how you. yeah. I think it's hard. Like, and I think.
All right. Good enough.
Yeah. Yep.
Other question, we mentioned 6 months here. Is that the period that we're thinking of for the accounting?
So 6 months, the reason for that is the rewards will vest every 6 months, right? And so yeah. I think it makes sense to update kind of to look at contributions on the same schedule. It's like every, okay. That's like a vesting period basically. And I think, okay, so this is basically for transaction fees, validator rewards. I think then the question is like, who gets access to the withdrawal credentials? And after talking with like a bunch of different people, it seems like this is what's at the highest risk of being very contentious. And I think this is probably where it makes sense for the EF to like draw the line. And I have some criteria below, but at a high level, how it would work is if you're already a mainnet maintainer and you'd like to like get access to the rewards, the next step is you basically become like a patron maintainer or a PM, which I know is like a terrible acronym, but bear with me. And the EF basically makes a call on whether this maintainer can become a patron maintainer. If you are a patron maintainer during the first like vesting period, so the first 6 months that you're one, you vest withdrawal keys, but those go to HLF. And then if you want your organization, so your employer, to have access to withdrawal keys, you would become a patron organization. Again, the EF makes the call. And then from that point, you start vesting withdrawal keys directly to your organization. And one thing that's nice with this is that it doesn't do any kind of like back weighting of all the contributions. It just looks at every single period. That said, one thing I think we wanted in the program is also to reward to some extent the organizations that have been supporting clients for a long time. So the sort of compromise there would be that the first period of withdrawal credentials, you only have Consensus and Hyperledger Foundation who are patron organizations. And then you can start adding some after that. And I'll just scroll right down to like roughly the criteria that, you know, I think we want to have to kind of move maintainers to patron maintainers and organizations to patron organizations. Again, this Dano, thanks a ton for the help here. First, it's just like, you know, how much and how big have, like, was the quantity and the impact of the contributions that like the maintainer and the org have done towards Baseview? And I think there, you know, we'd like to see several kind of large features, so, you know, EIPs implemented across several network upgrades, consensus critical fixes, like really, you know, these people and these organizations have like contributed significantly to Besu. I think the other thing, this is a bit more like a soft or like a fuzzy requirement, but like engaging with like the broader Ethereum mainnet community beyond just like the Besu community itself. And this isn't like, doesn't need to be huge, but you know, being in the ETH R&D Discord, showing up on Awkward Devs from time to time, knowing, you know, like being involved in EIP discussions that are relevant to you. Like, we don't expect people to be engaged in every single issue all the time, but like you should have shown up and like generally be aware of what's happening in the broader Ethereum community. And I think the other thing that we'd like to see, and this is more like the organization level than like an individual, but like basically being proactive around improving the Ethereum mainnet beyond just like writing code for support in Besu. And again, this is something that, you know, like I think organizations have done in the past, but whether this is like championing EIP, working on an R&D effort, helping just with testing infrastructure, with performance optimizations, things that like go a bit beyond just like supporting mainnet and being able to sync the mainnet. And at a high level, how this would work is, you know, once, if you have a mainnet maintainer, they want to become a patron maintainer, you just ask the EF, which for now would be me. We make a call on that. And then assuming that like you want to also have your org become a patron organization, then same thing, you just reach out and we make a call on that as well. I'll pause here because I feel this is like the biggest chunk of it. Any questions, comments? Okay.
Raise my hand, I'm the worst. And just to be clear, like I think you said this, but just want to restate this to make sure I'm right. Patron eligibility is solely decided by the EF.
Yes. And I think this is just
patron maintainer and patron.
I'm not sure who told this to me. Probably a lot of people have, but like this is so that like the Besu contributor calls don't end up being like people arguing about who should be a patron every 2 weeks. And I think, you know, we want to see Besu succeed. Like we do want to exercise judgment here, but like we're more than happy. Like if you come and you ask us like, what do you want to see? You know, I'm more than happy to like tell you and like kind of highlight, you know, the gap between like, you know, the contribution today and like what we'd like to see. And yeah, so I, you know, we want to help Besu succeed here. We don't, our goal is not to like block everyone from ever being a patron, but we do want, you know, it to be like the highest quality maintainers and organizations. And I think, yeah, it's probably just much simpler if the EF makes that call.
Yep, that makes sense. Just a comment feedback I like about this is that there's kind of a tiering to it. So, you know, you become a mainnet maintainer, you become eligible. Like there's kind of like little benchmarks for everything, which I think is kind of right. Nice. Of like, you know, once you can become a contributor, get started, become a regular maintainer because you've hit your, what is it, 3 or 5 commits? I don't remember, sorry guys. Then the next level is a mainnet maintainer, and that makes you eligible for transaction fees. And then if you hit the next benchmark, you become a patron maintainer. And then the like ultimate is the organization where there are multiple patron maintainers, which I guess I like that it's kind of a tiered reward system. And you kind of like, it's a clear path, hopefully, for contributors of kind of here's where you kind of can see yourselves and how you can continue to like work up and get there. So just
I love that. Yeah. And I think, it does make like a clear kind of gap between them. So I guess, it's worth maybe going just quickly over the two other kind of changes. So transaction fees, I didn't change anything except the idea of the, of sending the fees to a smart contract. The main reason there is it's just like technologically simpler. And also from an accounting perspective, I don't have a strong opinion on the contracts. Like I've used mirror splits in the past and it's worked well and it's optimized only for ETH, but the way it works is it, and there's a UI for it, which is helpful if it's somebody like me or Grace that needs to set it up and not, core dev. It's not loading. Okay, yeah. So basically how the split works is like, you know, you set up however many recipients you want. Each recipient has a claim over all the ETH that's sent into the split. And so very high level, you know, we can say 20% goes to the node operators, 20% goes to the Hyperledger pool. So you just have their two addresses with 20%. And then at the end of a period, we look at this mainnet maintainer pool and you just have a list of address for either organizations or individuals. And you also add those. And this means that like all the validators would use this split contract as the address towards which they send transaction fees. And then the transaction fees just sit there until somebody who owns like one of the addresses claims them. And the caveat is you obviously don't want to lose your key to the address you've put there, but that's true of any transaction fee address. And then these contracts cost like a little bit to deploy. They're not super expensive, but basically every 6 months you would need to deploy a new one. And you can use basically, you know, fees from like either the Hyperledger pool or somewhere else if you want to earmark for that to just pay for the gas to deploy these. There might be other splitting contracts. Like again, this is just the one I've used in the past and like I know has been like audited and also used like in a lot of projects, but generally this simplifies and it also removes the need for like, if say consensus's validators got way more transaction fees than the one pointing toward Hyperledger because they just got all the good blocks, then they would have needed to like send funds over. So this removes the needs for that. I see there's comments in the chat. Right. Yeah. So we want to be a bit mindful about when we actually deploy this contract and not pay super high fees if there's an NFT gas war going on. So this is like, I guess the like most complicated section and like I invite people to actually read this rather than just listen to me chatting, but like high level, I tried to model like what would withdrawal key distributions look like in a scenario where you have a bunch of other patrons joining you over time, who gets what. Basically, the two, I guess, important things there is one, you only look at like a single period. So you don't like look at all of the historical contributions, which makes it, you know, kind of reset every time. The one caveat is, the amount of withdrawal keys might not map directly to like the perfect split of contributions, right? If we're giving out 14 withdrawal keys, it might not go great. So I think what you want is you want to keep like a running tally of like how much keys, what share of keys would people have had if it was a perfect split and like what shares they actually get. And when we get the spots where like it doesn't line up perfectly, we just kind of top up the organization that's farthest behind what their fair share should have been. And so again, here there's like a scenario, but you can see after like four periods, so after four rounds of keys vesting, everybody's within like 3% of what they should have gotten. So it gets pretty close over time. And I think if we got to like the last period and there was like a large discrepancy, you can just then choose to like liquidate one or two validators and just, you know, send the ETH for them proportionally. So I think, you know, in like a 6 month period, there might be times where like, you know, some organization has less withdrawal keys than they would, and some have a bit more. But like, if you look over like, yeah, three or four periods, it tends to even out pretty quickly. So again, I linked the spreadsheet. There's a whole explanation that kind of walks through what's actually happening. Yellow cells just show who's a patron organization when. Red cells show that you've had too little keys relative to your contributions, and green cells show that you had too much. And this again was in the previous one, but also worth noting is just that if you liquidate, you basically give up your right to the mainnet maintainer pool. So the proportionally to how much you liquidate. So if you liquidate 100% of your validators, you can't obviously get a share of the transaction fees from everybody else's validators. If you do liquidate a validator, we expect you to send all the transaction fees that you've accrued before the liquidation to basically the transaction fee distribution contract. So you can't just like run away with the fees and decide to liquidate. And that's pretty much it. I guess, like I said at the beginning, you know, it would be helpful to know if there's any like strong objections to this from anybody, just, and if not, I think the next step would be for like HLF, Consensus, and the EF to start working on just drafting a formal agreement, and yeah, kind of getting this done. Yeah, I'll pause here.
Yeah, I've only had a couple days to look at this, but so far, so good. I appreciate the progress. I definitely see a lot of progress here. So it's looking good. I wouldn't say that I have any objections to it right now. I'd like a couple more days to sit on it, but I don't expect to have any.
Cool. Yeah. And I totally appreciate that. Like I dumped this, I think yesterday or Friday, I forget, but yeah, very late. And it is a 2000 word document. So yes. Harp?
Hi, Tim. Yeah, thanks for writing this up and making all the edits. As I commented in chat, I really like the way that you wrote this so that it seems to incentivize more contributions, which I assume should be the goal of the program anyway. So thank you for, as Justin pointed out, driving the document forward.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, thank you. I know it's been a process to get here and it didn't start off in the best way. Like, I really appreciate everybody's time and efforts to get this to a spot where it's much, much better. Cool. I'm happy to not hog up your entire contributor call once more and let you get back to regularly scheduled topics, if there's nothing else.
So just maybe to round this out, is this final? Do we say if there are no objections or disagreements by, let's say, end of day Friday, this is the final proposal, or any questions? Just because Justin's right, like let's give the broader group, I know not everyone is on this call, until the end of the week, but if there are no items raised, whatever substantial disagreements or comments, this is the final version, with the caveat that legal parties need to review in detail. Right. On the consensus side, we've done an initial review, but there will, as we said last time, the plan is to have, you know, if there are any changes that are substantial, we will like obviously show the final agreements with this group. But we'll try to keep that process as transparent as possible if there is a red flag or something that needs to be changed based on legal or financial requirements.
Are we happy with the maintainer definitions? I know that there was some discussion about that.
I can't raise hand when I'm sharing screen. So that's like a deeper discussion of if we want to review maintainers in general, but just there's a difference between a mainnet maintainer and a non-mainnet maintainer in this documentation that could be worth pulling out. But to become a mainnet maintainer, you have to become a BASU maintainer. And I think the definition of mainnet excluded things like Ethereum Classic, QBFT, quorum compatibility, non-mainnet consensus algorithms, if that's your primary line of work. So that, you know, that could be cleaned up. But I think the substantive contribution definition is going to keep us in line, separate of what is going on with the BASU and Hyperledger definition of maintainer.
Great. And who's making the decision on who is a mainnet maintainer or not?
Tim, go ahead.
Sorry. So yeah, I guess first to Daniel's points, one thing I would probably highlight is it feels to me like it's more fluid. Like I'll take, we talked about Diego's contribution on the last call, so I'll use him as an example again. But say Diego's main job is like working on Ethereum Classic, doesn't usually involve mainnet, but if in a period he does fix a log4j issue that's like a security vulnerability on Ethereum mainnet as well, I personally feel during that period he should kind of count as a mainnet maintainer, and it's fine if then he just goes back and only works on Ethereum Classic and never does the mainnet thing again. It's like, so I think it's like a bit more fluid. Like I could see somebody coming in for just a period and they don't necessarily do it again. Another example is I've been talking with Rai, who's I believe still a maintainer. He's working on an EIP, and if he came back, you know, once he's like we're ready to implement the EIP and like he actually implemented it in Basu and whatnot, like I would have no problem for him being a mainnet maintainer for that period and then just leaving and never contributing again, and like that's fine. Like so I whereas like a kind of a Basu maintainer feels like a strong binary, right? Like where it's you're like one or then you leave and it's kind of hard to leave and come back. So I think that's a bit more fluid. With regards to your question, Hart, like I would hope that the Basu community itself can kind of come to consensus on who's a mainnet maintainer or not. I think if there's cases where that's not possible, the EF and HLF basically need to make that call. But ideally, in the very large majority, it would just come from like the Basu community.
All right, go ahead. You were first.
No, you were first, Grace, actually. I was watching.
I don't know. I actually don't know if I think if the mainnet maintainer, any of these definitions outside of active maintainer, which is the Hyperledger and the Basu community, I think any of these that map for eligibility into the client program, I think should be decided by the EF, just to take it out of the, like, because we will spend so much time in our contributor calls, like being like, does this count? Is this right? Is this enough? Like, I think anything that makes you eligible for the client's incentive program should be the EF. It should be easy. It shouldn't like, and but I just don't want to, I think it'll just be too,
yeah,
too much.
I agree with Grace here, because I mean, so I don't know if you all know Mike Dolan from the Linux Foundation, but he has a number of cautionary tales where people gave money to projects and told the project maintainers or contributors or whatever to split it up by themselves, and this resulted in essentially the project actually functioning much worse with money than without, because people spent the whole time like bickering about who should be awarded for what contributions rather than actually getting work done. So if there are corner cases, like there are some things that are going to be very easy to decide, but if there are corner cases, ideally it could be the EF that could decide, you know, it's your money and we don't want to, the real thing is we don't want the communities to spend time arguing over compensation rather than like thinking about the code.
I think that's a reasonable ask. I just need to double check internally if that's an issue. Daniel, was your hand raised?
So I think one of the things to point out is that for the withdrawal keys, a lot of it is defined on going to the employer. So the patron organizations, I think that's going to be one distinction from typical projects that just receive money, is it's implied that your employer is going to be the one receiving it and then deciding at that point whether it backfills your salary or whether they send the team to Disneyland. And that's completely outside of the discretion of the program.
Okay. Right. Like, I think in general, we would probably default to that. Like, if somebody, even like for mainnet maintainers, like, yeah, if you're employed by like an org that's part of Hyperledger, we'll like default to sending it to your org. And then if you're not, we'll send it to you.
Yeah, are there any, like, I'm just thinking this through, if I'm an individual contributor, then the split goes to my cut of the split. Never mind. Let me think this through before I ask. Please continue. Don't wait for me to figure it out.
I haven't had a lot of time to look at the doc, to be honest. I kind of skimmed it a bit, but are all of these splits going to be via an organization, or is that are unaffiliated contributors going to be able to participate?
So for transaction fees, absolutely. Like if, again, I'll take Rye as an example, he's in my Telegram chat, but like if Rye comes in, implements like this history expiry EIP and says, this is my address, you know, for the next period, I think that's totally fine. I think for withdrawal credentials it's much, much easier if there is an organization for a bunch of reasons. But like if, again, let's take Rye as an example. Rye comes back, he wants to set up like a one-man shop to be like a full-time contributor to Besu and like hire somebody to work with him on that. And it's, you know, Rye Inc. You know, I wouldn't want, like, I don't want to place like an administrative overhead, you know, on them if they're doing the good work, getting access to the funds. But I suspect it would just probably be easier to be, you know, incorporated in one way or another. Does that make sense?
Not really. I mean,
right. So I guess it's just if you're just getting the transaction fees or validator rewards, there's no need to be an organization, unless it's not Ry Jones from Ricer. Yeah,
Ricer.
Right. So yeah, if you just
get easier to have an organization. Like an umbrella organization that would be responsible for distributing the more difficult to split things, because transaction fees are simple, but the more difficult to split stuff, it seems like you would need to have some umbrella organization that would manage those sort of splits.
What is the more difficult things to split?
Like withdrawals or however that ends up working out for a non-org contributor.
Right. Yeah. So that's kind of why I'm saying, yeah. So transaction fees are easy, right? You send them to a split contract. Anybody can put an address in it and they can withdraw on their end. And there's like a legal question there about like who owns the split contract, but it's not like rocket science. Withdrawal credentials are a bit harder for that because we do want to have like the EF will want an agreement with every one of these like patron organizations. And so again, like we can make agreements with individuals. It's probably just easier if there's some sort of incorporated entity. But like, if that's your problem, like, that's not like an unsolvable problem. Like, and I'll be happy to personally work with you to make it work.
Is the EF willing to kind of become entangled in governance over this? Is that something that EF will make a long-term commitment to if we're talking about having the EF decide what is and what isn't a substantive contribution?
So at the withdrawal key level, yes. At the transaction fee level is the thing I need to double check. And that's kind of my fear is like, you know, can we commit to this for years? Like definitely for like patron organizations and withdrawal credentials, yes, of course. But for transaction fees, that's just the thing I need to double check.
So I guess my question is, I raised my hand, I didn't see anyone else raise their hand, is It seems like, I think there's only, I don't think there are any objections. I just want to, just want to be mindful of our time box here. I think it sounds like these aren't objections. One question, but I think it's clear that a patron maintainer needs to be a part of an organization for them to be eligible for the withdrawal keys. And that's up to the EF to decide. The transaction fees is a little simpler for individual contributions. Is there any, I think the only issue or item that I don't know if we've agreed upon yet, and thank you, Dana, for taking notes, is the, have we agreed that the EF should start and end the decision of what is mainnet maintainers or what is eligibility to be a part of the groups within within the client incentive program? Do we generally agree that the EF should be the one making that decision? Or let me say this, does anyone disagree?
They make the final call for sure. It's a question of how involved we are before the EF gets involved, I think. And whether we should just do a proposal and time box it and let Tim do it, whether we should fight it out, or whether we should just let Tim start it from the beginning. I mean, those are really the three options.
Yeah, I would rather not have to proactively do it. And the reason is just because otherwise I feel like I might forget. I totally see the argument for like, you don't want to spend time arguing about this. And I'm happy to check whether the EF can help there. But like, for example, if you sent me a list of like 15 people, like they're, and like, you know, 13 out of the 15 are just like a green, like thumbs up, like they're good. And then there's two that like, you're not sure. And you have links to their two PRs or whatever. Like, I think that's kind of the best format from the EF's perspective is like, we could just look at that and like make a call. But like, if, for example, I'll take you then, you know, if you've been working on mainnet and like, you're still working on mainnet and like everybody agrees, you're still working on mainnet. Like, I would rather not have to like review that every time until there's like a contentious decision or something.
I think
we are at time.
Yeah, though. We're at time. I'm not sure I'm totally aligned with that, but I will follow up and send some notes back to the group. Dana, I liked how you kind of outlined the three options, but I will take that away to kind of make sure we get an answer on this in the next couple of days. So we're getting closer because, yeah, I'm not totally aligned. Okay, so with that, that's the one outstanding item that I will own. The second, and then there are, of course, I'm just saying this out loud, there are several obligations on the Hyperledger front that they need to confirm that they will be able to meet to be a part of this program, which are listed above. Basically it all cruxes on that. You know, if they can't meet those obligations, then this agreement can't work. So we can follow up on those just to be explicit. And then, but the idea is that, you know, with this three options on who decides who the mainnet maintainer, there's no outstanding items unless someone raises it. And if we are able to resolve this in the conversations the next couple of days, async, we will consider this proposal final. Sorry, that took me a while to get there. Cool. Okay, let's do the other items. Let's skip roadmap this time if everyone's okay with that. I think we want to talk about the release updates. Who is in a good spot to start writing that?
First, I need to unmute. How are we going with the 22.1.0 release? I've seen a little bit of chatter online. Is there something I can do to help it along? Does someone have the action item to actually get the release out? I mean, we're halfway through February for what was supposed to be our January release. Is there help I could provide, or who has the action item on it? Or should I take the action item?
So we started that conversation last week. And I think I saw some action on it from Sally's perspective, but I don't know if that is actively being worked on at the moment. So I would say let's sync up with the Australian time zone, see what they have done or need to do, and then get something out this week.
Okay. So this kind of underscores a concern I have with the releases, is that we need ahead of time decide who's got the action to release it. I can propose the rotation. I'll take the 21.1.1 release. I'm assuming that, and also the 21.1.0 release if needed. But I think we need to get a schedule where we identify specific people who are responsible for driving the release. A year ago, it was always the Chupacabra team, and Tim was always really good about making sure that it happened. But I think the key here is that there is one person we can point to and say, hey, how's the release going? So I think that's...
Yeah, agreed. I think we have a wiki page that has a schedule that hasn't been updated in forever, right?
It's historic reflecting, not forward looking. Okay. This is lists when the releases should be, but it doesn't say who's driving the release.
Yeah. Okay. So then we just need to set that up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Are there any volunteers who wants to be on the release rotation list? Is there names I should put on it?
Yeah, you could put me on there.
Okay, Justin, me, does Sally want a term? We'll let Sally, I'll write up a note on it on the chat and see if Sally wants an overnight run on it.
Yeah. I mean, we've got a bunch of people in the European time zone as well.
Good.
That are familiar with doing releases and have cut them. So
I would like to be included as well in the release.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the same.
All right, Kareem. And so we need to, I assume this would be for all releases, not just the quarterlies, right? Are we still going to opportunistically do the 2 week ones, or do we want to get into more of a cadence on those?
I think we need to be on a cadence, and I think we only stop the cadence if there's an explicit reason not to release, because we keep the older versions out, and that's where we were a year ago, and it seemed to work well. And it also made it easy when there was, you know, regular, when hard forks start happening again, and especially with the case with ETC, when they did a short notice hard fork, it's easier to say, hey, we have a 2 week release, we'll get it out then, which helps release planning, to be honest.
We want to have a volunteer release coordinator for, minor releases, the major releases, quarterlies, or is it, are we going to be responsible for individual point releases only?
So that's the question. Do we split up each beta into a different person? But also we need someone to drive the quarterly. The .0 is going to be a bigger task there. So we're going to hit that come April. Let's try the dot releases and make a call as we approach the next beta cycle and see how that's going.
Yeah, go ahead and put me on the volunteer list if you would.
Okay. All right. Cool. So that was just my question and concern with the releases. We need a more explicit process around it.
Yeah, it's a new problem that we've got multiple teams and multiple people that are doing releases. So this is just some coordination we haven't solved yet. It's a good problem to have.
Yeah. Okay. That's it for my take on releases. Anyone else got any questions?
Okay. Yeah, the only thing that I would say, which I just reiterate, is I think there should be somebody that is a release coordinator who's going to be responsible for gathering what should go into the specific releases on a quarterly basis. But like you said, we can approach that as we come to the next quarterly. Because I think part of the problem with why we haven't gotten a 22.1.0 out yet is that it's unclear who makes that call, what goes into the release, what doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
I mean, Tim's role. Yeah. Tim and Madeline were running that a year ago.
Yeah.
We've had the back and forth with whether release candidates are going to be
more betas and alphas or whether they're going to be release candidates, because the 22.1 is a bit of both right now.
Yeah. So there was an org chimera that collectively made the decision. I don't know how things are structured right now inside consensus. But it seems like we need to externalize that process and name a person who has the go, no go, or at least a council. Cause I know Fabric, they have a group of three people. They also only do quarterly releases that are the no go committee that has to approve all big releases. So maybe we need to form a release committee like Fabric has.
I think, I suck at raising my hand.
Go ahead.
I think, Sajida, are you able to kind of own this? I know this, and kind of at least run it from the, consensus side, and then coordinate out and say what's the right kind of next steps so we're being transparent and running this. I like Dana's point that it should probably be regular releases and just getting that up and running.
Yeah, definitely. So I think it's interesting because so last year we had lots of discussion around the release process, whether it should be like a regular frequency or if it should be feature driven. And so we've experimented with various models. Currently, we have stopped doing regular releases for minor months and just keeping the quarterly. But it seems that this quarterly has been delayed. I think it has to do with how the last couple of weeks went with the Log4j issues and lots of minor releases for customers and specific hard fork and stuff like that. So we'll get back on track for this. But something that is worth discussing, and to Dano's point around the model that we use, it's still unclear to me if it should be just a model where, for example, every 2 weeks we release, or if it should be feature driven. Because I know, but I'll let the engineer speaks to that some find this model to be not so efficient.
I like the go, no go release committee idea, but it would be nice if we could just coordinate via Discord. That way it's async and it's not like another meeting agenda that we need to prepare and have everybody in the same time zone for. It'd be interesting to have an async go, no go committee.
Mm-hmm.
But so we have to agree on the philosophy basically around this. And I know that the fact that the release process has been a pain point has also impacted that discussion, because having regular releases when lots of things went wrong and it took a lot of time was also a factor that we wanted to try to diminish. But things have changed now. We have more people able to release, trying to open up the release process to all contributors. So this is... again, a nice problem to have, and let's discuss how we want to move forward. But from the coordination perspective, happy to do it and continue doing it, basically.
This is another thing that we could continue the conversation on Discord about. It's I'm excited to have a Discord Hyperledger Basu contributors.
Cool. So let's move this to Discord then. Running out of time, but I just want to put this out here. It's not going to be something we probably decide this week. We need input from the Australian engineers. But one proposal I want to seriously go towards is to move to Java 17 as a baseline this year. Part of that is because 8's already basically out, is not fully supported. 11's going to be going through the deprecation cycle too. But most importantly, there are a large number a performance-driven functionality that's been added in Java 17, things like sealed classes and records that we'll be able to leverage to get more performance and quality out of the client. So the process for that would be at some point we would decide we're going to switch to Java 17 on some quarterly release. It's probably going to be July or October at this point, because we need to have a full, for something of this line, what we've done to practice in the past is there is a full quarter. Last time we went to Java 11 as the baseline, there is a full quarter of notice saying, hey, the release coming up in July or October, whenever we decide, we're going to switch to Java 17. So they get a full notice, and then we do the full breaking change in the quarterly release. And then we switch over and start doing all the neat, fancy things that Java 17 unlocks.
I love the idea of doing it quarter two, end of quarter two. and I'm terrified of doing it right around the merge.
Yeah, and the merge is going to be in July.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that really, that's a really strong argument for making it October, to be honest.
Yeah.
Is the reluctance around doing it at the merge that it introduces some unknown to the code base? Because I think
it's 100% FUD. I have no actual reason for being scared.
Okay.
Yeah, because I think that Java 17, I think that it's more of a concern for enterprise clients because that's they would have infrastructure that might be Java 11 specific. And I don't think that there's any I don't think there's a significant base who can share of mainnet that's block producing. I think there's basically no block producing base. So it seems like if we manage to capture some part of that at mainnet, it wouldn't be terribly difficult to bootstrap with 17 as opposed to 11.
So will we have 22.7 out before or after the merge? Because we can't do it on 3. We don't have enough notice. I mean, can't do it on .4 because we don't have enough notice.
Is Tim still on the call? I mean, some people still are saying June, but...
And the next question is, will the merge be running from mainline Beisu?
Yes, it will.
Yeah, it will.
Okay. We could put that it will be merged to 17 no sooner than the .7 release, and we can make the call closer to .7.
Yeah, that sounds good. We'll start the communications to the affected parties, like probably, I'm guessing, more the enterprise type crowd.
Start a discussion on the mailing list, I guess.
Is that no later than 22.7.0, Dano, or no later than?
No sooner than.
No sooner than 22.7.0. Okay, so 22.1 is, okay, gotcha.
But we could throw some, you know, experimental builds in .4.
We could. So we already support building on 17. Yep. Shifting to 17 really introduces language features and shuts down running on stuff before 17.
Yep.
So if we were going to do it in 4, we would have to put the notice in the .4 release as it comes out today or whenever that happens next. And I think it's a bit too early for that. If I started this discussion back in November, I think we could have gotten there.
So, I was thinking like we could include it as we have the debug variant Docker image that we could have it, make it available, treat it like an RC candidate that's out there. We still have all the testing burden for it. And we have the right. You know, any backwards compatibility stuff that we have to get rid of, but then there's no pressure to introduce any new features. That all happens on whatever schedule we want it to.
I think I should set up a JDK latest Docker image that we always have out there anyway, to make sure that it starts up and runs on JDK latest. So we don't need to add it to the debug because we've got one for GraalVM. We've got one for latest JDK.
That's right.
I remember recently having to fix it because we had to rebuild the Docker images because of some security issues.
Yeah, this is mostly about deprecating 11 as and new language features as they come, but this is mostly about making it such that we don't support 11.
Because 12 through 16 are already end of life, so it's just 11 is the only question. Although don't tell that to my current company because I still have to dig around for Java 14 and Java 16. So I don't think we have enough people and enough exposure to this to act today. So I'll take the action to put an announcement on Discord and put a post on the mailing list targeting no sooner than 22.7. If things go poorly, we'll slip to 22.10.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable.
And the messaging is just, we are deprecating the 11 image. It's not going to be continued to work on. It's not going to get fixes. It's not going to get support.
We'll build on 11 eventually.
It won't even build on 17. That's the big thing. It won't build on 17. So, I mean, it won't build on 11. Right. It'll only build on 17 or later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Those are the two big things I wanted to have discussed.
Cool.
We're on Discord. Should we set up a midweek chat sometime next week? Just set a time.
Yeah. Yep. Love it.
What days work?
Oh, I don't have much of a life. Pick one.
Should we just do Tuesdays at the same time this meeting would be? Just block it off and just be on Discord chat, or do you want a different time?
That might actually be bad. What? Let me check.
Okay.
What participants are we targeting?
Diego wants to get on these. Basically, anyone who's contributing to we could rotate it. I just want to get some non-recorded chit chat going on between all the maintainers, so we have weekly connection.
Yeah. I think during the show and tell slot, it's fine.
Probably. Yeah. That would be this time slot, Dana.
Mm. Okay. Oh, you moved show and tell earlier. Okay. Mm. I'll start a thread on Discord as well for this. See what people want.
And like having an APAC and an EMEA would make good sense. That way you could span the contributing time zones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are a couple more items on the agenda. I think Diego wanted to talk about the log4j deprecation. I don't know what the Docker image signing one was, but anyway, let's follow up with these on Discord, and we can add them to the top of the agenda for next call.
I do have a quick update on Docker signing. That's going to be difficult for the LF to hold keys, so that's going to be one major bump there. The way that Fabric does their key signing for their Maven uploads is they trust one engineer to be a nice person and not share their keys, which kind of defeats the purpose. And LF, they have a lot more overhead in maintaining keys than a lot of organizations because they're a giant target, to be honest. So that there's going to be speed bumps there. I think it's a good idea, but we're probably going to be leading the charge for some things that'll need to be led in LFX. So that's just, to set expectations on that. I think it's a good idea.
Okay. Time to get creative.
Yep.
Thanks, guys. I think we can call it. I think I listed some next steps and actions in here, so we'll share out this as our notes for after the call. And feel free to read and give me feedback. Bye, y'all.
Awesome. See y'all.
Cheers.